Has the show already begun without me? I guess the theme song has already started to play, correct, Anshar? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to technical difficulty number 17,000. Essentially, I was in the preparation of introducing our special guest on today's episode of Frank About Health, and my browser shut down. So I am now communicating this episode on my handset. But it has happened before, and I'm just doing it again. You live and learn from experience. Today's special guest is about neurodivergence and communication. That's the name of this episode of Frank About Health. And my special guest, Anshar Seraphim, is a perfect example of how one has lived his entire life with neurodivergence and has made the best out of it. We're going to learn today about his living life with autism spectrum disorder and his sensory issues that he has had to also learn how to cope after being nonverbal until the age of about 30. Now, I want pretty much to have an open-ended discussion on this particular episode because I'm familiar with Anshar's work, both with talkradio.nyc, as well as his expertise as a consultant with the neurodivergent community. And you'll learn more about that on this particular episode. I'm going to issue my fundamental disclaimer, which is that any of the information that we discuss today are not the views of talkradio.nyc or of Frank About Health, but rather it's a case story of an individual, a neurodivergent individual who has really made the best life for himself, given all the limitations and given how he has taught himself how to live a functional life within his community as well as within his profession. That all being said, I want very much to introduce Anshar, or rather let him introduce himself to all of you and give you the whole perspective of who he is. So, Anshar, welcome to Frank About Health.
Oh, thank you very much, Frank. I'm Anshar Seraphim. I was about 75% nonverbal with autism until about the age of 11. Had a lot of challenges, and I know a lot of people don't know this who don't have autism touching their lives, but I do have a lot of the physical problems that go along with an autism spectrum diagnosis. I had one of my eyes turned all the way in to the bridge of my nose when I was born. I had a strabismus, had to have it corrected with surgery. Would often engage in a lot of vestibular self-stimulation, rocking, hand flapping, a lot of sensory issues. I do have synesthesia, like four different kinds. And my life has really been a journey of, I think, just wanting to connect to people. When I was younger, I didn't really understand human relationships that well. I remember I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I remember trying to chase the other kids around on the schoolyard, trying to kiss them because I didn't understand human intimacy or friendship. I didn't. I was raised by two women, so I didn't really understand gender roles. When you don't have exposure to a circle of friends or role models or a society, no one ever really tells you how to act. Those are things that you learn from exposure, and so.
Correct.
I didn't have, no one was there to tell me I shouldn't, play with dolls or, so I do identify as non-binary, but I don't have that feeling that I was born in the wrong body or anything like that. It's not I'm not experiencing gender dysphoria in a typical way. It's more that without initiation to any of the social constructs, the only thing that I've ever had in my life when people have expected, colloquially male behavior out of me was frustration because it was just another social role that I didn't know how to fill. My sensory issues are pretty debilitating. I didn't get my driver's license until I was 37. It was a big problem for me just because there's so much sensory input and we get into some of my challenges later, but I couldn't have a conversation while driving. I couldn't have the radio on. I couldn't have, even a crack in the window because then I would start feeling the breeze on my skin, and that would start making me see colors. And
And it would
so it was
also
a
be painful, wouldn't it?
it's not always necessarily pain. When you've got sensory dysregulation, you get a heightened sense of anxiety.
Right.
And then, it's a self-propagating cycle too, because once your anxiety goes up and you start having those stress responses, it actually changes the way that your brain processes somatosensory and visual and auditory information. So it kind of turns into a cascade effect. I do want to kind of give a little bit of commentary, because you said that I was nonverbal until 30, and it's not entirely accurate.
Accurate. Okay, I appreciate
75%
that.
nonverbal until age 11, and then
Okay.
I really started trying to connect with people after that, with a lot of challenges. We can get into that. And I didn't have my first friend until I was about 25 years old, aside
Yeah.
from maybe doing an activity with someone else around me, a shared activity, but there was no social interaction aside from parallel play. So that was really frustrating. But I really came into my own as I started to approach 30 years old, just because I had, if you know anything about autism spectrum disorder, there's all kinds of there's a reason it's called a spectrum. People have all kinds of different challenges, and as for me, generationally speaking, because I'm here, I'm in my mid 40s. It was only 2 years before I graduated high school before they even had Asperger's in the DSM. So I came from that generation before, we started passing out, ADHD diagnoses and all of that to kids, and trying to fill them with amphetamines and stuff like candy. There was no support or recognition, of anything that was going on with me, and I never could understand why I wasn't able to connect with anyone. Ton of social challenges, inability to make eye contact, inappropriate facial expressions. I'd spend most of my day, walking around with my arms crossed, looking at the ground. A lot of difficulty with the tonality of my voice, being able to control my tone. No gesticulations, no facial expressions. I felt like I was from a different planet. I couldn't connect to
Wow.
anybody. So, what happened for me is, like many people on the spectrum, I had a lot of special interests. And being socially cloistered the way that I was, once I started reading, that really opened up a different world for me. And I ended up going into so many different special interests, words, puzzles, games, all kinds of things, that eventually I came across a book by Carl Sagan, The Dragons of Eden. And in it, he talks about the evolutionary consequences of human thought. And how the fact that, if we assume that evolution's true, what does that mean for the way that we think and feel and process the world? And it occurred to me at that point, because I had gone through a severe depression after actually getting a diagnosis when I joined the well, I tried to join the Navy. I was a sailor, went through boot camp and all of that, but I ended up having, some of the same problems that I did my whole life and didn't understand. And when you get access to free healthcare and all that, the military, you're a lot more, I guess, motivated to try and, seek medical attention and all of that. And things had moved along so much further by that point in my life, as
Right.
far as an understanding of autism. And when I got my diagnosis, in some ways it was empowering, but in other ways it felt like, the desire that I had to make things better, that it was never going to happen for me, because that meant that there was something that I couldn't control. So I got very, very depressed. I tried to take my own life.
Wow.
Ended up being hospitalized for mental health as a result of that. I was homeless for 11 months, one of the coldest cities in the United States. And it made me, really aware of how much of a problem mental health in general is for the indigent population. You make a lot of social connections and see a lot of things when you live a year homeless. So
Right.
that broadened my understanding. But reading that book really did something unique for me, because it gave me a chance to ask myself kind of an interesting question, which is, I had all these special interests, because when you have ASD, there's a phenomenon of interconnectivity in the brain where things are stored differently. You process information differently. It can cause you to get somewhat obsessive, really, about a particular topic, or playing with a particular concept. And so I asked myself, what would happen if I made the brain and psychology into a special interest? Would it change anything?
Right.
And it changed everything. It changed everything because for the first time, I started to try and not only understand, my limitations and my challenges, but to try to rewire my own brain to be able to circumvent, or improve some of those things. And it took a phenomenal amount of work, thousands of pictures of my face, trying to figure out facial expressions, lots of work with my voice, because I came to understand that my own voice was actually causing me sensory dysregulation. That my because I'm a baritone, so I had to learn to speak like an octave and a half higher, so that I could work on talking without it bothering me. And it just kind of I kind of failed upward from there, because the first thing that you learn when you're neurodivergent is you learn about masking. You're desperate to connect to other people, and so you try and emulate the social behaviors and all the things that you see around you, even if they don't make sense. And it's a fundamentally flawed process because the better and better you get at it, the more socially punished you are when you make a mistake. And I think it's only like 2.5% of people who have Tourette's actually swear. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, you're one of those people. If you were able to completely suppress all of your tics, your twitches, your profanity or whatever for an entire dinner date, then you get to the last 5 minutes and you drop an F-bomb, you've really set that person up to have the worst possible reaction by not going forward from the very beginning, being direct about your challenges. And the other problem is it's social and emotional, because if you convince yourself that you have to pretend to be someone that you're not in order to be able to make social connections, and that means that when you do finally make those relationships that you're seeking so desperately, that you're in the worst possible position to feel confident about them, because you'll secretly feel like if people knew, who you really are, that they might not love
They'll
you,
just
they might
leave.
not be with you. So yeah, I guess that's probably, more of an introduction than you wanted, but I wanted to give a little bit more context because it's just autism spectrum is just so wide. There's a lot to
I know
talk about.
what is interesting is that, and I know we have a minute before our break, but you did exactly everything that I would have probably asked, because essentially you brought up the autism, you corrected me on the age at which you were nonverbal, which was fine. I welcome all corrections because I'm still learning about this. Neurodivergence for me is about epilepsy, but I know autism in itself is such a complex myriad of issues. But more importantly, as I titled this episode, Neurodivergence and the Power of Communication, the very skill sets that you had to learn in order to get your desire to connect to others and build relationships and be as functional as possible, given all of your limitations, it was your ability to use various levels of communication training, like the octave in your voice, or even how to blend neuropsychology or cognitive neuroscience and brain science with psychology. That is all the dynamics that all of us, I wouldn't say average everyday people, but all of us are striving to build upon. We always spend our lives trying to improve on our limitations when you had no choice but to do that. So that is the power of communication, which is why I look at your situation as debilitating you had indicated it has been, but it was your secret weapon. It became your gift and it empowered you on so many levels that maybe you're still exploring, or maybe you've already begun to see some of those rewards. So for that reason, Anshar Seraphim, to me, you are an inspiration. And I want very much the rest of my audience, the listening and viewing audience, to see how you've mastered not only that skill to be able to allow you to relate to others, but how you have made it into various opportunities along your life and career that could lead you to being a role model for anyone who's neurodivergent, whether it's within the spectrum or even other types of neurodivergence. So that's my my praise and my platitude for you right now on Frank About Health. And when we return, we're going to talk more about your sensory issues. I know that's a challenge. And but I want to spend the remainder of the show showing how you used those challenges and made them very productive and profitable. All righty.
Sounds great.
Okay. All right, so I have been multitasking left and right, trying to get myself back on the main screen. So I'm going to mute my audio and video. We're going to go into our first commercial. And then when we return, hopefully I'll be back on the main screen with all of you right here on talkradio.nyc and on all of our social media. Please stay tuned.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a high-achieving, growth-oriented leader? Are you interested in developing your authentic leadership while creating a healthy, inclusive workplace? Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Bronku, host of The Hard Skills on talkradio.nyc at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, where we discuss how leaders develop the hard skills needed to make a greater impact. We interview experts, have live coaching, and tackle these challenges. Listen to The Hard Skills on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a purpose-driven individual looking for deeper healing, clarity, and growth? Welcome to the Expansion Room, a transformative space for purpose-driven individuals. I'm Siobhan Larice, host, licensed therapist, and coach. Join me every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. And I'm back with everybody on the same playing field. That being said, Anshar, thank you for being on this episode of Frank About Health. As you know, I wanted to have another autism show, but your story is so unique and so different and so inspirational that I want to talk about mainly how you've been able to adapt to a much more realistic coexistence with all of us, both personally and professionally. I know that there is one of the limitations that I have not really understood in various people who are on the spectrum, but you have some kind of sensory dysregulation disorder, or you said there's another word for it. I want to use
sensory processing disorder.
Oh, okay, great. So can you explain to me that while you were already going through the spectrum and becoming more verbal by the time you reach 30 and then making your first friend later in life after that, how did you manage to strive and thrive while still dealing with ongoing sensory issues, whether they're sound related or touch related? Can you show me how they either differentiate or probably even work together?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the easiest way to kind of relate the autistic experience for people who aren't familiar with it, and you know, all I can do is speak to my own experience here. So, you know, take that with the appropriate grain of salt. And sure. I do want to point out, you know, I'm a behaviorist. I'm applied behavioral psychology does not make me a therapist or a medical expert in any way. It's important, you know. But speaking to the facts, the white matter tracts in the brain, the corpus callosum, the different ways that your brain processes information, those things change when you have autism spectrum disorder. And I think the easiest thing that I can liken it to that a lot of people have, you know, as a relatable experience is that feeling that you need to turn down the radio to park the car.
Right, right.
You know, there is interference that happens from your sensory input. And have you ever had like a bad phone call where you could hear your own voice on like a half second delay?
Yeah.
You ever notice how difficult it is to talk?
Yeah, you end up stopping. You freeze.
Yeah. So if you have sensory issues, if you have, input processing issues, it dramatically changes your way of being able to communicate. And it's like there's an interfering noise in what you're trying to do. And a lot of the compensatory mechanisms that you'll see in autism, you know, like vestibular self-stimulation, like rocking, or, verbal or tonal repetition, like a echo or palatalalia, it's kind of like a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. It's that while you can't control all of the input you're getting, by mixing it with input that's expected, that you can make it more tolerable. And that's where a lot of the, eloping behaviors, compensatory behaviors come from, is this inability to turn down the radio to park. And you've got to try and figure out a way to make it palatable enough for your brain. But then you're also dealing with the challenge that as that input continues, the frustration and the stress continues to escalate. And then that makes you even more susceptible to being dysregulated. It's why, at least I can speak to my own experience, you know, a lot of people on the spectrum won't even necessarily be able to identify when they've had they're in the middle of having a meltdown or a dysregulation until after. You know, it's a very humbling experience to be a grown man, you know, and to have a meltdown in a public place. You know, I think one of the primary frustrations when you have a disability is that it takes patience for other people who want to be in your life to be with you, whether that's a physical infirmity or a sensory problem. You know, other people are going to have to make some accommodations for you. And ironically, strangers are the most accommodating. It's the people that you know that are closest to you for the longest period of time that are most likely to forget that your symptoms are not character traits. You know, if you have ADHD, and you forget a friend's birthday because of executive dysfunction, it's very likely that a person's going to get their feelings hurt and feel like that's your fault. Right. Whereas if you had a friend who was in a wheelchair who didn't offer to help you pack because you're moving, you wouldn't, you know, you have a constant visible reminder of their limitations. And when you're neurodivergent, you know, depending on whether or not or how you physically present, people right. don't have that cognitive reminder. So it can cause a lot of problems with social mistreatment. You know, if a person's not able to look you in the eyes during a job interview, you know, it creates social problems. You know, there's a reason that the unemployment rate for autistic adults is, you know, in some places up to 85%. And that's before you get into things like transportation challenges and the workplace environment and, right. you know, the ability to switch tasks. And, you know, we can get into some of that if you want. I don't want to flood you with too much information.
No, but I identify with everything you're saying, because I've always said on various episodes of Frank About Health, perception is everything. And it's incredible how sometimes perception is misconstrued and made into reality because the person or people that are perceiving or misperceiving the other individual are also limited themselves, and they're not taking the time to even give the other side of the coin, so to speak, or even try to empathize with what you might be living with, which would therefore make your situation much more respectable and transparent if they were able to think objectively rather than, oh, well, you didn't give me the reaction I expected, so you're not to be dealt with, you know. And it's unfortunate that that's the kind of social system we live in. And, you know, I've always talked about how narcissism also plays a, a path into all of that. But again, this is about your disorder. And it's just that I think identifying with you as an epileptic individual, I have a lot of empathy and respect to the kind of challenges that you could possibly be thinking or feeling, you know, like when we're not even speaking, let's say. So I'm the type of individual, I think, that always tries to give the benefit of the doubt, sometimes even to my own detriment. But when I look at an individual such as yourself, I know that I'm going to get transparency from you. I know I'm going to get as much mutual respect from you that I can give to you and vice versa, because there's no other choice in how to function, you know. And what I find a little bit of a shame, and this is my own little disclaimer, and I wouldn't call it a disclaimer, my own little commentary for the society out there. If people are worried about feeling bad that someone didn't call them, for example, on their birthday, think about what that other person is living through. Try to, you know, that would be my recommendation. And then therefore it'll help reduce their own guilt or insensitivities or whatever.
I think the problem there, you know, you could take it back to like tree and brain theory. Not that that's, you know, a current good psychological model, but the idea that once you start feeling things like in your limbic brain, it impairs cognition. You know, when you have a strong emotional response, that is not when you do your best thinking as an individual.
Correct.
So, you know, if something that you do causes an emotional reaction in someone, that is their least best time to reason. You know, I think it's Jonathan Swift who said that you can't reason, you can't use reason to reason a person out of a position that they didn't use reason to get into in the first place. If a person's having an emotional reaction, their ability to be emotionally mature, now, you know, but this is also a secondary part of it, and I want to speak to it. Sure. And that's that if you had, let's say, a neurodivergent child,
okay,
that is hard. You are going to have to endure some suffering with that. You are going to have to put a bunch of effort into things that come easy for other parents. You're going to have frustrations. You're going to have the social problems of people, you know, thinking that your kid has a disciplinary problem, you know, because often things like eloping can be mistaken for things like oppositional defiance disorder. You know, how many times can you get called into the principal's office, you know, for your kid, you know, quote unquote, disrespecting a teacher when you see that someone's just not recognizing the fact that they're different? That takes effort and frustration, and it is not easy. It is emotionally valid to feel frustrated. It's emotionally valid to feel hurt that someone didn't remember your birthday.
Right.
The difference is where do you point those feelings? You know, if you're caring for a neurodivergent child, they're not the appropriate target for your frustration. Right. Do you have a right to process that frustration? Absolutely. You know, do you maybe need a support group or a therapist or to talk to someone or have a healthy coping mechanism? Or absolutely. You know, it's not that, you know, we live in a world where human beings are absent of feeling. It's about being able to own and recognize emotions, understand what the antecedent is, what made that emotional reaction happen, and how can you make positivity out of it? You know, how can you direct that energy, that frustration, into something that appeases it, but doesn't cause harm? And that takes self-awareness. And self-awareness is not in large supply in the world.
No,
it's just not.
It is not.
It's just not. So I think that, you know, part of communication and really just treating other people equitably, you know, we're all taught from a young age this idea of the golden rule. You know, treating other people the way that you want to be treated. And it's honestly an awful philosophy. It's great for a stranger. When you first meet a stranger, you know, trying to give them the provisional extension of the way that you want to be treated, maybe that makes sense. But once you know someone, it's not about you anymore. It's about treating them the way that they need to be treated. It has nothing to do with you. And what you try to do is surround yourself with people who can understand that ethos and do the same for you. And I think that it's an opportunity for growth for a lot of people. But being able to separate how a person is making you feel from whether or not they have responsibility for your feelings and whether or not they should, you know, have negative feelings directed at them because of it. Because a lot of communication problems actually erupt from it's almost kind of like revenge empathy. You know, this person made me feel a certain way and they're not acknowledging or validating that feeling. So I'm going to force them to feel what I'm feeling. and that's, it causes a lot of impulsive behavior.
You know, and that you lack find of that in most does. Individuals that classify as narcissistic.
I mean, to some extent, you know, if you get into clinical narcissism, it's a different topic because what you're really dealing with that, with like NPD is a person has incredibly low self-regard. And because they're having incredibly low self-regard, they believe that they need to curate all of their relationships so that they can control other people's impressions of them and then obtain what's called narcissistic supply. If that's something that you're interested in, you know, Sam Vanekin has a really great book on that called Malignant Self-Love. It's important to make the differentiation because in psychology, you'll have some terms that, you know, might seem confusing to a layperson. Like, for example, you know, the difference between positive and negative punishment or positive and negative reinforcement. When we think of narcissism as a characteristic, as a personality trait, you're talking about a person being self-absorbed, egocentric, having a high opinion of themselves. And really, when you're dealing with clinical narcissism, it's actually the opposite problem that creates the behaviors.
Well, we have our second break right now. I think we went a little over, but I wanted you to get everything out there because I think everyone needs to learn how your story actually resonates into a role model of sorts so people can learn how to adapt or regulate as best as possible with their loved ones, whether they are neurodivergent or not. And so that being said, everyone, please stay tuned because we are now going to uncover what Anshar was able to create just the last 4 months that is revolutionary in my view, and hopefully you will see the same. So please stay tuned right here on Frank About Health on talkradio.nyc and on our social media. We'll be back in a few.
Misalignment within your sales team or with a client stalls deals and creates unnecessary friction for you and the client, resulting in up to 37% lower win rate. If you're in pre-sales, sales, sales management, or sales enablement, and you'd like to increase revenues, win rate, margins, client satisfaction, and stay competitive, this show is for you. Hi, I'm Art Fromm, host of the Making Seamless Sales Show. Please join me live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host the program Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I'm Linda Marsanico. The A Train to Sedona is a memoir about my journey to love and compassion. It's also the name of my new broadcast on Wednesdays at 12 noon. When we are spiritual, we embrace possibilities and ideas, which strengthen our mind, body, spirit, health, and wisdom. On the A Train to Sedona broadcast, I plan to interview guests who embrace these expansive practices. Join us on Wednesdays at 12 noon on Talk Radio New York City.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. Right now, we are going to have a little bit of an introduction to a ChatGPT LLM model that Anshar programmed himself. And it is called Ask Anshar version 5.0. It is a, what would you say, a gift? Or would you say a service that you have provided to the neurodivergent community? I qualify myself as being a member of that community, so I have been using it extensively, I am proud to say. And I wanted pretty much to show here, for those of you looking at Frank About Health on your mobile phones or tablets, this is the screenshot of what rules to actually ask it or how you can use it using the ChatGPT portal, but in particular, Ask Anshar 5.0. That all being said, I'm going to let you, Anshar, completely describe what made you program it, how did you learn the language to do so, the LLM, I guess they call it, and also describe out there how it benefits a lot of users.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest frustrations when you are neurodivergent is what you're supposed to do in social situations. You know, social situations can be confusing, hurtful, frustrating. You know, and it's it really operates on a lot of levels. Human relationships can be really difficult and frustrating with autism because mm-hmm. there's so many silent rules. You know, you're supposed to understand sarcasm. You're supposed to know what appropriate emotional responses are. You're supposed to be able to, read people's body language and facial expressions and tonality. And when you're already dealing with so many sensory issues, you know, if you have difficulty with eye contact, for example, let's say, you know, the input of a human face is overwhelming when you're trying to think or talk and you have to visually disengage, you never really get the opportunity to learn and understand those things in the same way that neurotypical people do. Mm. And, you know, I had to stumble my way through so many problems, lost friendships and broken social connections and not understanding, you know, what it was I was doing wrong. And I had to spend so much time studying, you know, people in the brain to be able to overcome some of those challenges. And I still have a lot of challenges to go. And I didn't have a resource, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't have the internet. You know, I was, you know, paging through my grandmother's, you know, Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia and going from topic to topic. But no one ever really teaches you how to interact with people. You know, it's something that you learn from people. And so when you're socially excluded or you have a lot of challenges, you kind of experience a developmental delay. And what I wanted to do with Ask Anshar was use the advent of AI as an opportunity to give a tool, give a social decoder for neurodivergent people to understand social situations, you know, facial expressions. You know, why is it that, you know, if someone finds you attractive, they'll look away from you when you look in their direction, but if they don't want you to talk to them, they'll also look away when you look in their direction. You know, a lot of those signals can be really confusing and frustrating. So right. I wanted to give other people the benefit of what I had learned in my, you know, at this point, 3-decade journey, and give them the benefit of that. And, you know, AI represents an opportunity for that. And I, you know, while there's some ethical problems, I feel, at least personally, with ChatGPT and OpenAI, and, you know, there is a commentary there about, you know, global resources and environmentalism. You know, I don't think a lot of people understand that watching a single program on Netflix in HD is equivalent to about 600 GPT queries. You know, it gets different once you get into image and video generation. But, you know, if you're talking about, you know, server resources and water and power and environmental pollution and all that, you know, the fact that we stream so much video in the current, you know, economic climate, right. It's way more deleterious to the environment. But that aside, there's not really a lot of resources out there. So what I did was is I wanted to not just make a custom GPT that would help neurodivergent people, but also to help neurotypical people too. You know, I put a lot of effort and a lot of psychological research into dating profile analysis. So I have like a dating profile red flag analysis built into it. It's able to walk you through the neurodivergent experience, you know, and help you develop and code, you know, some social skills to learn by way of exposure some of the things that no one can ever really take the time to teach you, and try and put it into a way that you can communicate. And I also, it was important to me to make sure that as a resource, that it was able to understand all of the different issues that can happen with neurodivergent communication, everything from info dumping to, you know, ADHD circular storytelling. And it's completely neurodivergently friendly in that if you wanted to, for example, you can hit the voice button and you could do all of the ADHD circular storytelling you want about what's, you know, what's happening. And it'll still be able to accommodate all of that. If you're not a great communicator, you have communication difficulties and you only type it a few words, it will still recognize those as complete questions and responses and give you, you know, the information that you're looking for, even if you're not fantastic or you have motor coordination issues. And that is completely free. You can get a link to it on my LinkedIn, and it is available as a public resource. I've got 30 years of my experience put into it. It is not intended to diagnose or treat any illness. It's right. It's literally there to give you, you know, some social information, be educational. And it can even, you know, help you learn about people, whether you're having issues in the workplace. You know, I think all of us have had that frustration of not having enough social context to know what's happening in a situation, to understand the emotional and psychosocial dynamics that are at play. So I wanted to give that as a resource. It was my, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the weak and strong anthropic principle, but the idea is, you know, this would be the strong anthropic principle, that I wanted to be an ancestor for the people who come after me, because I've seen so many changes. You know, I didn't get my diagnosis until I was 19 years old. And now the average age of diagnosis for autism is like 4 years old. And to think generationally, how different my life could have been if I would have known a decade and a half earlier, you know, where some of my challenges were coming from. If I would have had a resource to be able to understand those confusing social situations, my life could have been significantly impacted. And since I didn't have someone there to do that for me, I wanted to be the person I was missing.
Well, this is impactful enough. I mean, granted, there was the time, quote unquote, lost, if you will, but you have already, by being able to create, especially with a new platform like artificial intelligence, this whole entire community solution for both neurotypical and neurodivergent people. I think that's making you catch up to what you missed out on. That's my view. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to take our final break. But one of the other aspects of Anshar's trajectory in being able to relate to all of us, besides creating Ask Anshar 5.0, is his own neurocognition consulting business, which we're going to learn more about when we return. That being said, please stay tuned right here on talkradio.nyc and on all of our socials, and we will be back in a few. On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Ready to serve up success with a splash? Hi, I'm Bruce Kramer, a.k.a. the Corporate Cockroach.
I'm the Renaissance Woman, Angie Snowball.
And I'm your strategy doctor, Dr. Navtej Dasanjh, inviting you to serving up success with a splash.
Join us as we shake things up with real talk and real strategies centered around awareness, action, and accountability.
And yes, there really is a cocktail involved. Please join us and sip your way to success.
Serving up success with a splash, where wisdom meets happy hours. Cheers!
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. Actually, besides the fact I had shown you Anshar's business card, I was going to show you his YouTube page with previous work that he has done, but I guess in all of the shuffle that started at the beginning of the show, I have lost the link to that. So that being said, Anshar, I really want you to spend the remaining part of this show talking about what you do for other businesses, other professionals, I guess within the neurodivergent community, or even others, researchers, hospital systems. I mean, I'd like to know all about the kind of work you do, and feel free to say on this show how people can get a hold of you, if they could probably use your brilliance on ChatGPT or even with other things that you have done. And at the same time, if we have screen sharing privileges, so if you want to show your YouTube page, feel free to do so, but just go ahead and promote yourself to the hill.
Well, I teach applied behavioral psychology and cognitive neuroscience for business, sales, personal development, marketing, neuromarketing. I help entrepreneurs connect their ideas to their audiences. You know, I've had the pleasure of, you know, being interviewed 60 plus times on the topic, everything from how your vocal tone and your choice of language can change a sales interaction, to how belief systems can impact the way that we affect change in our lives. I think some of the core principles I like to touch on are the gaps that happen, because when you don't always necessarily understand the mechanics of the brain, it can cause people to make a lot of mistakes. And I want to, you know, touch on a few of them. I think most people have had the experience of having imposter syndrome, for example. So just as an aside, you know, a lot of people don't know this, and psychologists disagree. It's anywhere from 5 to 50 times. But did you realize that when you have a negative experience, that it's recorded with 5 to 50 times the clarity of a positive experience?
Yes.
Because the hippocampus, the memory writing system of your brain, you know, and we now know through, you know, voxel parcellation studies and all of that, that memory has a lot more to do than just a single centric area of the brain, that they're, you know, engrams are stored in a different way. But right. When it comes to things like narrative and memory, when you make a mistake or touch a hot stove or almost get hit by a car, you know, the brain, when it has a stressful reaction, it's evolutionarily predisposed to record those things with far more clarity and granularity. It's why we have a perception of things slowing down. You know, if you're in a car accident, you have a negative experience. It's why, you know, most human beings will have that common experience of, you know, having one eye open at 2:30 in the morning, thinking about a job interview that didn't go well 15 years ago. The brain revisits negative experiences. And what that means to us as human beings is that the mammalian system, the animal system that protected us with evolution, that it negatively impacts us as thinking, feeling human beings. Because once we're transcending from survival to a life that isn't just survival, those same things like negative memory and, you know, negative experience storage, it impacts our narrative as people. You know, I always found it confusing, especially being a, you know, kind of a very logical person. You know, when I would see a bunch of people high-fiving and, you know, pom-poms and cheerleaders and all of that. But there's a lot of truth to the importance of creating novelty impact on the memory when you have a positive experience, when there's a win, because it helps derail the negative narrative that will happen from the funhouse mirror warping of your memory. Right. You know, if you live a life where the only memories that are recorded with real fidelity are your negative experiences, how could you have anything but imposter syndrome? It's right. A really predictable effect of that. And I think it's important to understand, you know, mechanisms like that, understand how that warps the narrative, understand how people will change their impression of you or your product or your service based on their own experiences and emotional reactions, and why certain customer demographics need to be separated from one another, or objections need to be answered differently, or where emotional objections come from, how it influences decision making. you know, how to properly respond when someone has a negative reaction. You know, what is a positive and what is a negative way to reframe or to set, you know, boundaries or guardrails? Or, you know, there are so many dynamics when it comes to interacting with people. And I think one of the few benefits that I've gotten out of the autistic experience is that my cup was empty. You know, I had to learn these things that people are, you know, have different gradations of good and bad at. Right. I had to learn from having no skill at all in that department. You know, I had to dissect all of those things and come up with a system for myself to be able to understand those interactions so that I could try to excel in a social environment. And I never intended, you know, to become a psychology expert. I was just trying to work on myself. You know, I worked in information technology for 2 decades. I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life behind a desk working on, you know, computer problems, because it felt like that was the only way that I could have a successful career. And then when I started getting better and better at psychological understanding, at neuroscientific understanding, right. And recognized how much of a gap there is in the way that personal development happens and the way that people change their behaviors and the way that people form their identities or try to transmit their identities. You know, what happens with challenges like copywriting or emotional impressions or objections, or there's so many interesting dynamics. And it's, I think one of the coolest things about studying psychology is that it ends up not just helping you develop as a person, but it teaches you more about anything that you have to do in the world that involves interacting with other people. You know, right. How do you transmit a skill effectively to another person? You know, and that's a really important question to answer too on the subject of imposter syndrome, because the easiest way to circumvent imposter syndrome is to transmit your skills and your sapience to someone else. If you can effectively teach another person how to do something well, maybe the first time your brain will still be full of doubts. Oh, you know, I got lucky, or they're an outlier, or maybe they're better at it than me, or whatever. Right. But once you've helped 50 people be successful at something, you don't have to worry about having a negative impression of your own understanding anymore. And that's because you get to see the social proof in other people. You know, we view people and ourselves differently with spotlight bias. And there's so many different kinds of bias that creep into the way that we perceive ourselves in our world. And they're really important things to understand. There's a reason that understanding neuromarketing, for example, is so important. I've had the privilege of leading a team of 4 PhD neuroscientists for a neuromarketing department before. And it's really crazy how much of an impact. Like, if you look back to the 80s with Coca-Cola, you know, they...
New Coke.
Yeah. You know, they let themselves get basically dragged down into the mud with a taste test challenge when that wasn't actually what was important to their market salience. What was far more important was the psychological recognition, the cultural recognition that Coca-Cola had. And by not understanding those psychosocial dynamics, it ended up costing them, you know, millions and millions of dollars. So I try to do that now for businesses, for individuals, for entrepreneurs. I've had the honor of speaking at the United Nations Autism Awareness Event as a public speaker, bringing neurodiversity into the public view in any way that I can. I volunteer my time with communication groups, you know, people with who are neurodivergent and are struggling. Yes. And I feel that, you know, those skills are human skills. You know, that they're transferable to everyone, that everyone has an opportunity to benefit from them. And if it's something that, you know, if you want that honest psychological impression of your copy or your website or your business process or the sales process you're using for your team, or how to deal with objections, or, you know, an acquisition of a skill, all of these are things that you can benefit from by being able to talk them out with another person. And so, you know, out of all of this whole process, that's how I became a consultant.
So Ask Anshar is not just your portal, it's also what you do. So that being said, can you give verbally all the links that you want people to try to reach you at, including your YouTube link?
I think the easiest way to find me would just be to go to LinkedIn. And you can just put my first and last name there. There's not a lot of Anshar Seraphims out there. So it's Anshar and then Seraphim, Seraphim. And then you just put a period in the middle of that between my first and my last name at gmail.com. That's my email address. I have my electronic business card, which I've given you, and it has links to a lot of my interviews and content. So I'm sure, you know, via the show links, if anyone's interested in that. I offer 90-minute sessions. I do sales process design, marketing analysis. I don't proffer myself as a coach most of the time, but sometimes, you know, coaching is part of sales. Coaching is part of marketing. I think coaching really is just about, you know, bringing in someone who has a different perspective, because sometimes we can get so hyper exposed in an industry or in a particular process or a sub process that we start to get blindness to some of the important dynamics that we're missing from an outside perspective. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, consultants can do really well and bring a lot of value. I have a personal philosophy where, you know, if a person makes a session with me, you know, it should make them one hell of a lot more money than it should cost them to spend time with me. So, and I try to transmit that ethos, you know, professionally.
Well, he certainly has done that both on today's show, given the way I came in, as well as the way I have been able to see him interface with other hosts here at talkradio.nyc. I'm sorry, Anshar, but the show is over and I had so many other questions. I will obviously probably be having you come back at some point. I'll talk further with you about that later on.
Viewers get any questions and they want to write you or post questions or send me questions, it's always something that we could do in a follow-up episode if you like.
Absolutely. In fact, maybe even talk about the narcissistic personality disorder system. And I think you have some expertise in that area from our own private discussions.
I think a clinician would probably be a better choice for that. True, but if you're looking for some great information on that, like I said, the book by Sam Vanaken, Malignant Self-Love, that's fairly authoritative. There's a lot of great resources out there. I think one of the primary things that you should know as a person is how to identify when you do encounter dark triad personality types and, you know, how you should handle those situations. Being able to establish good and enforce good personal boundaries, knowing strategies when dealing with those kinds of people. Because even if a person with NPD, for example, wants to seek help and they're even actively engaging in talk therapy, that can be really, really hard. They have a very low success rate because you're literally giving them the narcissistic supply that they need while you're trying to treat them. So I think you're probably a more qualified professional on that particular topic, but it is something that, you know, I could maybe point you in the right direction for a resource.
I appreciate that. So ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for Success with a Splash with Bruce Kramer. And then afterwards, Making Seamless Sales with Art Fromm at 7 p.m. right here on this network. Thank you again, Jesse, behind the scenes. Thank you again, Anshar, for everything that we have talked about before, during, and after this show. And I will be back next week with a new episode of Frank About Health. Please stay tuned, and I will see you all next week. Take care.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you again. On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I'm Linda Marsanico. The A-Train to Sedona is a memoir about my journey to love and compassion. It's also the name of my new broadcast on Wednesdays at 12 noon. When we are spiritual, we embrace possibilities and ideas, which strengthen our mind, body, spirit, health, and wisdom. On the A-Train to Sedona broadcast, I plan to interview guests who embrace these expansive practices. Join us on Wednesdays at 12 noon on Talk Radio New York City.
Hey, everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host the program Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your Conscious Consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a high-achieving, growth-oriented leader? Are you interested in developing your authentic leadership while creating a healthy, inclusive workplace? Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Branku, host of The Hard Skills on talkradio.nyc at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, where we discuss how leaders develop the hard skills needed to make a greater impact. We interview experts, have live coaching, and tackle these challenges. Listen to The Hard Skills on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.